Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And the clocks have gone back, winter is a-coming, but as are the burglars. So we'll give you the top tips on how to keep your home safe in the dark. Also today, we run through some of the consumer rights we get wrong and whether booking through a third party will affect credit card claims. Also, should you help your kids pay off their student loan or save for a house? And do you need a pension wake-up call? Plus, we love a good coin story, but what about comic books? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, the clocks have indeed gone back. We got an hour extra in bed. That was probably the only positive thing when you think that the nights are drawing in and the burglars are as well. Theft insurance claims go up a third during winter months, and it's often because we aren't doing the basic checks. So how do you make sure that you don't become a victim? Well, This Is Money have been talking to the hardware retailer Robert Dias to get some tips. So Lee, welcome. Why do claims go up so much in winter months?
It's just a bigger sort of time frame in which burglars can kind of operate. You know, they like to tend to operate in darkness rather than in broad daylight.
You can understand why. Yeah,
you can understand why. And it's more obvious when you're not in the house, probably, you know, things like lights, you might not have lights on and that type of thing. So thefts tend to go up. Also, there's a, especially in the run-up of Christmas, you know, that people might have bought more high-end gadgets and that type of thing. The chances are that there might be more things gift wrapped, literally, to be nicked and stolen and taken away. So what we were trying to do in this article is not scare people, to say you're going to get burgled, but there are definitely things that you could be thinking about to protect yourself. Actually, one of the interesting stats in this is that 5% of all UK burglaries are down to an unlocked door. I mean, you know, I know it sounds so stupid, doesn't it? But, you know, 5% of all burglaries may not sound that much, but it is more than enough when you think about it. So you just got to protect yourself, make sure that you're doing the right things when you're in and around your home. Another thing that I always think, maybe not so much this time of year, but social media, people posting pictures of being on holiday, being away from your home. You don't know who's watching. You don't know the information that burglars have. You know, they've got more of a picture about people than ever before. It's easier.
That is frightening.
It is frightening. You can kind of build a picture of what you're doing in a day-to-day life. Now, this is more professional gangs, I would argue, than just a run-of-the-mill kind of young burglar that's gone a bit awry and just, you know, opportunist. You know, you get a kind of a difference in the two. You get one that would probably be more targeting like a high-end car that's on the driveway, for example, and they're looking to come in and get the keys and make a getaway. And then you get the ones that are kind of just, you know, doing it ad hoc and
opportunists.
Exactly. And just trying to get in there. So in this, we were trying to think about everything that would be going through the mind of a burglar. Now, it's quite difficult, not being a burglar, of course. Yeah. But we had a story a couple of months ago in which we were saying how easy it is to, you know, for some of these burglars to take the opportunity to pick locks and all of the sort of things that people might be doing, you know, not to keep their home safe and their property and their possessions safe. So it was a kind of a follow-up on that. And one of the first things is to think about your external boundaries and thinking about protecting your gateways. So what we mean by that is making sure that all of your locks are where's the last time you checked, for example, lock on your gate? Okay, yes, they potentially could jump it, but don't make it easy for them by just having like a bolt just the other side that can be easily unlocked. A lot of people don't think about that. You could have stuff that's way better. The technology in those kind of locks have improved, better materials, harder to get at. And things like external lighting. So, you know, the lights that go off, especially something like in your back garden, you know, it kind of deters a burglar because all of a sudden they're lit up and they're in your garden. It all sounds very simple and you're sitting there probably thinking, God, this is all such basic advice. But I think a lot of people, shutters come down, and until it happens, it's never happened to me, but I imagine it is one of the most galling, horrible invasions of privacy that you could ever imagine. And it's kind of getting to that thought process of trying to prevent this from happening. So, for example, I recently replaced our front door. We had a PVC front door. I was told that they're quite easy to crowbar open. You know, basically, if someone wanted to get in, they could get in quite easily.
They don't look very secure.
They don't look very secure. So, you know,
I've never tried to crowbar one open, but they don't look like they would, you know, take too much work doing that.
We've got a new front door. We've got a new lock. And even the lock on the old front door just looked a bit like it could just be sort of shoved open, you know what I mean? Like it didn't look secure enough. And it's just, I'm not saying go out and replace your front door, but have a look at what if you were, I would look at your home through a burglar's eyes. You know, what are your weak spots? What could you be doing? Another classic one is just to have a dummy. You don't have to get a whole alarm system set up. You can have a dummy alarm put in the front of your house. There's a stat out there. I can't remember it off the top of my head, but a lot of burglars will simply just avoid homes that have a burglar alarm. And it can be quite difficult to know.
The same with cameras, don't they?
Cameras.
It doesn't have to be on.
And the other thing now, so we looked at some of the smart tech you can get now. And a couple of interesting bits of smart tech, I thought. You know, those doorbells. I thought, what is the point of one of those doorbells? I think Ring. So it has like a little camera. I think, what is the point of that? You know, but actually it is kind of motion sensored. So if someone approaches your doorway, or if you had one wherever it is in the property, it will then film that bit, and you might have the face of someone that's sort of snooping around your home looking to attack. There's quite an interesting new technology when it comes to locks. So you can have a front door now that doesn't even have a key lock. You just have a number lock, but these are like really enhanced. So my thought process of that is, well, what if someone's just looking over your shoulder or peering away with a pair of binoculars? But let's say you had a four-digit code.
Or you stumble home after a few beverages.
Yeah, you can't remember your code. A bit like your PIN number.
Sorry, you've got to think of these
I read
things.
This and it sounded to me like a recipe for me not getting into my house as well as the burglar.
Exactly. But I thought it was quite interesting because...
Well, at least it's safe, Simon.
What I was going to say about this is like your four-digit code doesn't have to just be four digits. So you could embed it in like an eight-digit code. So as you type in it, the person from the distance wouldn't know what your four digits are, for example. So there's all sorts of this tech out there. And, you know, at this time of year, it's the perfect time of year to just do an evaluation of your property. As I say, spot the weak points and just do some research and what you can do to make your home secure.
So it's basically a little bit like Home Alone. Do you remember that scene where, you know, the lights and the music and the... When you said dummy, I thought you were going to stop at dummy, but then you said a dummy alarm system.
Yes, when Joe Pesci and the other burglar are sat outside and Joe Pesci says, all right, ready, and counts it down. And then all of
music.
The timer alarms, lights go on in all the houses, one after the other.
We laugh. My mum, bless her cotton socks, she used to have, you know, light system timer thing. She'd always put on the radio when we left. I mean, she went to town back in the day, and I used to think, oh, what a waste of energy. And all that, but actually,
it does make sense because basically, a lot of burglary is opportunistic. What you want to do is make it that your home won't get chosen for the opportunistic. Ideally, nobody's home would get chosen. I should point that out.
Yeah.
But you want to make it that your home won't get chosen. And the simple things like having a light on, they might be like the wet bandits in Home Alone. They might know that you're not there, but they might. There might be someone in.
Yeah.
It might be a small psychopathic child who's armed to the teeth, ready to take them out.
And why would you risk it? Unlucky. Actually, our next door neighbours got robbed four times and we never got robbed ever.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying it's because Mum decided to
was
whack
it
up the
radio, was on?
But you know, but you're right. Yes. Given a choice, you know, they're going for the easy option.
Yeah, but the whole thing about people leaving windows and doors open, I mean, that is, again, classic. That's opportunistic, isn't it? Trying the windows and doors. The amount of times that I leave a window... Our kitchen window is a nightmare for being left open. And our patio doors out to our garden. I mean, bear in mind that I live in London as well.
Yeah.
People will be listening to this going, what a maniac, you know.
They'll be trawling your social media to try and find out where you live, Simon.
Yeah. But there is, some of these gadgets are very clever. And I must admit, I'm a bit unconvinced by some of these things. One, it's like, oh, look, an opportunity to spend a large amount of money.
Yeah.
And two, there's that whole privacy thing, isn't there? It's like I don't allow an Alexa in my house. Do I really want these cameras set up? I'm quite anti CCTV society and things like that. So do I want to then set it up in my own home? What about when we discover that actually these things are always recording and your footage of your really boring life is being uploaded to some colossal database somewhere that no one will ever watch? But you still worry about the privacy element. But there is here, there's one of our options. Those willing to splash out a little bit more can opt for the Netomo Presence Outdoor Security Camera, £249.99, which automatically detects movement from people, cars and animals. As well as lighting up the area, it will send a notification to your smartphone so you can check the location via video link to see whether someone is walking up your drive or if it's just your pet walking up the driveway. It might not just be your pet, though. It might be me. Because I went to my friend's house over summer and he's got something like this. We'd stayed up late and we put the kids to bed and then stayed up late. But his wife was in Ireland with their other two children and she was having to fly back really early. So she'd got up at about, I don't know, like half, some crazy time, like half three, 4 o'clock in the morning. And her phone suddenly went and alerted her that someone was on her property. And she looked at this video link and she saw this person walking up the front garden. And, to the, and she's like, what's going on there? Who's this? And then she saw them go to a car. She's like, whose car's that? What's it? Why has they put a car on my drive? And then she's like, oh, it's Simon. I'd gone out to the car to get something before I went to bed.
But there's a real, so that's, I mean, that's quite funny, but there's a real sinister element to that. I mean, imagine she was not saying anything about your friend. Imagine in a totally different scenario, someone might be checking up on their, you know, family. Oh, it's all a bit sinister, isn't it? But either way, there are tips that you can use.
Well, what's funny, though, when, so Lee was saying about the doors, like the UPVC doors, one of the classic mistakes people make with those, actually, is they don't lock them properly. Mm. They don't do the thing where you have to, you know, a lot of them you have to lift the handle up and then turn the key, and they don't do that, and so they only half lock them. And you get that a lot with patio doors as well, is you do actually need to lock the things properly, and quite often people don't lock things properly. But we sit here and we talk about these, you know, PIN number codes to get in or sensors to get in. And I jokingly say this sounds like a recipe for me not managing to get into my house. And we're quite mistrusting of all these technological solutions to doors. Yet we live in a digital world surrounded by all this stuff. True. And we still think that using a key to open a lock is by far and away the best method of locking or unlocking a door.
Yeah.
I wonder how long we'll keep doing that for. You know, at what point will the pin code thing just take over? Will we look back in 30 years' time when we're sat
here
doing this podcast in our old age? Oh, do you remember that time when we thought nobody'd ever get rid of keys? I haven't seen a key in years.
Well, it's the same with hotels. It's the same with cars.
How often do you lose them?
Well, that's true, yeah. You regularly you lose your keys, you forget your keys, you leave your keys in another bag, you lock them in the house, lock them in the boot of the car. Don't take your keys with you when you go to your mum's house, all that kind of stuff.
There's lots of things. I mean, I don't know, in terms of those PVC doors, blimmin' heck, I can never get out of the blimmin' things, let alone get in. But either way, there's a security. I'd make a rubbish burglar. But what does all this do in terms of insurance, Lee? If you're going to get rid of things like your PVC doors, because we hear this a lot, don't we, about having the right lock. What type of lock do you have? A triple doodah woodah? Did your insurance premiums go down because you...
Is that the technical term?
Yeah, pretty much.
I must admit, when it always comes around to doing home insurance and it asks you what lock you've got, and I'm usually always filling these things in at work, and I think, actually, I've got no idea which one of these descriptive locks I have. And I always end up just hazarding in a bit of a guess.
You end up down the rabbit hole of Googling the different types of locks and you find some guide to what lock you've got, and all of a sudden 4 hours of your life gone.
I haven't actually renewed home insurance since Georgie, so I couldn't tell you the answer, I'm afraid. But, I mean, in theory, the safer your house, the less you're you know, likely to be burgled and your risk goes down. But a lot of it is postcode dependent more so than your own individual circumstances. So, you know, if you're in a bit of a burglary hotspot, the likelihood is, you know, you're going to be paying more for your premium because you're more at risk. I just think we've had actually the last couple of years, I mentioned it earlier about car thefts of driveways. I mean, that has been one of the big trends, I would say, in the last 5 years. And actually, that's been a little bit down to technology and keys. When we think about a lot of these thefts are happening with what they call relay thefts. So basically, they're mimicking a sensor from the car key and then making off with your car. You know, so the advice is to put your car key somewhere safe in
a lead box.
Exactly. Buried in a nuclear fallout bunker.
Exactly.
But, you know, again, that is part of your property, isn't it? You know, I think a lot of people just bung their car in their driveway and they don't necessarily give it much thought beyond that. But, you know, you need to keep all of your property safe. And that's why we were trying to think about it as not just your house, but as all of the external boundaries that surround it and making sure that everything in that space is safe.
Another tip as well, Simon, because a lot of people will be going away on holiday over the winter months, unsurprisingly, get a bit of sunshine. Things like mail, leaving it there on the doorstep if it's going to build up, get someone to get it. There's other sort of bits and bobs if you're going away.
There is a tip here to stop your mail deliveries. I'm not quite sure how you do that. I've never actually looked into whether this is
a thing that's possible. Yeah, just shut the door
Actually, just ask someone to come in and go round. Every so often, you know, pick up the mail, check everything's all right, make sure that you haven't been broken into, that you haven't got any pipes that have burst or anything like that.
Yeah.
And do remind them to lock the door on the way out.
Yeah, anyway. Right, we're going to move on from this. There's loads of information. This is money, so please do read it and feel a little bit more secure, because as Lee said, you know, we jest a little bit here, but yeah, I can't imagine. It must be absolutely horrendous to have someone go through your belongings. But we're going to stick with going off on holiday, because you have a question from a reader who paid for a hotel in Greece using hotels.com that sadly wasn't quite as described, let's put it that way. So we always, on the show, we recommend paying for anything using a credit card over 100 quid because of that added protection under Section 75 of the Consumer Credit Act. However, in this particular instance, after complaining to Co-op Visa, they said, the credit card company, no can do. Tough, basically, because the hotel was paid for through a third party. So the question then, from your reader, Lee, to you, is the credit card company right? And is this also the case for other websites like eBay or Skyscanner? Okay, so just unwind it, but first things first, I mentioned there's Section 75. Just what is that?
It basically gives credit card users protection if you suffer for a breach of a contract or misrepresentation when buying anything. So what that means is if you get in dispute with a company that you've bought something from, using a credit card gives you that extra layer of protection. And that's why, you know, you tend to say if you're booking, if you're buying expensive things, something like a flight, for example, you know, we argue that it's worth booking with a credit card and, of course, paying it off straight away so you don't get stung by any high APR or anything like that. Because you, by law, your credit card company is just as liable if you suffer a breach of contract as the company that you bought it from. So you can even part pay with credit cards to get this protection. Sometimes people do that as well. This opens up a bit of a box, actually. It's one of those things that I've always not been complete. It's a bit of a grey area, I would say. It's a bit complicated. So a lot of us now will use, let's talk about holidays because it's probably the most easy way to describe this. If you were booking a flight directly with BA, you could use Section 75. If you are booking on something like booking.com or Expedia,
which lots of us do, don't
we? It's classed as a third party. So because of that, Section 75 doesn't actually apply. So in the case of this person that we had get in touch, they booked their holiday, a hotel in Greece, through hotels.com. They turned up in Greece and a lot of it wasn't as expected. So the swimming pool had no water in it, so they couldn't use the swimming pool. You know, things like that. So it is almost like mis-selling, isn't it? It's like misrepresentation on the website of this hotel. It wasn't up to scratch. It wasn't what they expected. And they went to claim for Section 75 of the Co-op and they turned around and said no, because it's gone through a third party. So actually, we had a look through what Section 75 doesn't cover. And one of the things that it doesn't cover is when they're bought through a third party. So things like PayPal, things like Amazon, if you're getting it through a third party's marketplace on Amazon.
PayPal's an interesting one because you think it's slightly different because the whole premise is to be a bit more secure. It's not like you're booking through.
Yeah, and I should point out here that, you know, you should really go through PayPal in the first instance anyway to, you know, try and resolve whatever issue it is that you've got. But
right.
It's very hard to have that. You don't have the safety net of Section 75. And that's what we were trying to highlight in the story. And things like Expedia as well. You know, they may have their own payment protections in place and dispute elements, but you can't use Section 75. And another common example that you might have is money transfers. It doesn't cover that, and it doesn't cover cash withdrawals, which I think most people would know, but I think a lot of people might not realize this third party element, and it shouldn't shape your habits, because at the end of the day you might be able to get a holiday through Expedia or through a third party website that's going to be far cheaper or better price, and you might be able to get it directly. And most of us, but some of, you know, some people do book flights separately and hotels separately, but we're always told if you get it all encompassing, you may get things like Atoll protection, you may get a cheaper price. But can't rely on your credit card company if something goes wrong.
Where is your first port of call? Because of course it doesn't necessarily mean just because there's a third party you've got absolutely no right, you're totally stuffed, does it, Simon?
No, and I suppose you should go to hotels.com in the first instance because that's who you booked it through. I mean, I would imagine that you're probably highly likely to then get punted in the direction of the hotel. But you did book it through hotels.com. They did sell it to you, so that is your first port of call. You could also, if you've got a decent travel insurance policy, there may be the possibility of making a claim through that. There are elements of travel insurance policies that will cover some of these things, but you need to have chosen one that has that, and that's likely to not just be the cheapest one that you quickly bought in the queue for the plane. But as we've seen with, you know, lots of stuff that's happened in terms of holiday firms going bust and things like that, that's why it's always worth having a decent travel insurance policy, because actually quite often the difference in cost is like £10 or £15 or something like that. And it's like, well, if you're going to spend the money on travel insurance, you might as well spend the extra £10 or £15 and make sure that you've got some good stuff.
Okay, well, that's that scenario. But there are a number of cases where I think are quite similar to this, Lee, where we think we have consumer right on our side, but actually really we don't. And you've got Champion, the complaining cow. That's what she calls herself. I'm not being rude there. She's run through some of the most common examples. And the one that sticks out for me is when something is on the shelf at the wrong price. I actually think, Simon, it was you that told me this was not the case. That the shop doesn't have to honour that price. You're shaking your head there. But I always thought that was the case.
No. And a price tag is an invite to treat.
Treat.
Yeah.
Interesting.
There you go. The trader is therefore not bound by the incorrectly priced tag. It's up for negotiation, though, so you can always haggle. I mean, some shops will sell it to you for that price. So take it up and say, this is on the shelf for £29, you know, but you've just told me it's £49, but it's on the shelf for £29, so you should sell it to me for £29. And you might be able to get it. I mean, it's unlikely you're going to be able to buy something for something that's worth 400 quid for 50 quid.
And actually, if you say to them that I think the wrong tag is on here, they look really scared, as though I think a lot of sort of sales assistants don't realise that that's not the law either.
Yeah, and then you might end up with the manager or something, and they might know, or they might just decide to sell it to you. You never know. It's always worth chancing your arm, isn't it?
Yeah, why not? What else is in there, though?
I ordered an item from Amazon, from an Amazon seller, and I then got told it was out of stock. It went back into stock, but at a higher price. I think I should have it at the lower price. Doesn't work. A company, obviously, if they were doing this frequently, putting things on, taking them off, putting things on, taking them off, then it would probably backfire, as lots of people wouldn't buy their products and wouldn't trust them. However, this is the situation where, no, it doesn't work. You can't just say to them. The other one that was quite interesting was, this was an example that had been sent in by a reader. I put a fridge freezer in an online shopping basket from a well-known retailer, which was advertised as free delivery, but waited for my wife to see it. At 3 p.m, the price of delivery had gone up to £30. That's really deceptive. Why can't I have it at the price at which I put it in my basket? Well, the site, in this instance, clearly displays the costs for delivery. They were offering free delivery as a special price. But just because they're doing that whilst you're browsing, if you haven't actually bought it yet, you don't qualify just because you say, well, I saw it and I was browsing, you know. It's strange for it to suddenly go up from nothing to £30, but there might have been a limited time offer. And effectively, until you put your order in, then you are at the mercy of the company potentially changing the rules. And then there's a classic one here. I bought a top to go with some trousers, and when I got home, I found they didn't actually match. I took the top back the next day, still with the tag on it, receipt, and it hadn't been worn, but the store wouldn't give me my money back. Now, shops are entitled to do this. Shops do not have to give you your money back if you bought something and their policy says that they won't give you your money back unless it's faulty. If there's something wrong with it, then they do. But just changing your mind doesn't mean that you can get your money back. And this is a classic one where quite often people will do this within the sales, won't they? And shops will have different policies for the sales or different policy to normal times, or they'll have a time limit on it, 28 days or something. And being a person who's prone to inertia, you take it back on the 29th day and then they refuse to give you your money back. And this has happened to me before, and you end up arguing it with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes they will give you your money back. But I have had it before where a shop, I was one day over, we ended up arguing about what day the 28 days actually started on. Unfortunately, there was no way I was going to win this argument. I knew this in my head as I was doing it. I was like, yeah, even the line of... So I must have been 2 days over. Even the line of argument I'm using that was actually yesterday. I wonder whether they'll realise this. And they did realise it.
But chances are, you make a point though, chances are they will probably honour that, because you do, there are different protections if you order it online where you've got 14 yes. days where you can change your mind regardless of what happens.
Absolutely,
so if
yeah.
you just go, you know what, I'm just going to go and I'm going to take my business elsewhere, I'm going to order online now, it's killing the high street. So I think they tend to...
They do. And you might have a very good reason for not having made it back in, and you may point out to them that you will never shop in their shop again. However, sometimes it doesn't happen, and I've had that happen to me, and it was something that was bought for me as a present. It was in Ted Baker, and there was a very, very good reason why I had not been able to take that back in. Mm-hmm. And it was literally a day or two over, and they refused to give me the money back. I had the manager there, and they just wouldn't give me the money back. And I said, look, I'm just never going to buy anything from you ever again. This is not a particularly wise idea. You know, I can see this item, you have it on the shelf, it's still full price, you're not losing anything here, kind of thing. But yeah, so you can find it where they can just go no.
And when was that?
That was a few years ago.
And a few years on, you still mentioned it, and now it's one of those things. Right, we're going to completely shift gear now. We're going to revisit a question that continues and will continue to be on the minds of many parents. Now, last week we spoke about the stresses that young people face trying to get onto the property ladder. Well, as a parent, it's more than understandable that you'd want to help them out. But firstly, first and foremost, you need to consider yourself and your own financial future and happiness and security. But then, what about if they have a student loan to pay off? Do you look to tackle that first? So this is a question that was on the minds of one of your readers. Lee, take up the story.
I think what you need to do to think about this story, if you don't have a child or a grandchild that's currently going through the university system or has recently gone through the university system, is knowing how much debt university students are getting themselves into via the student loans company. We're talking probably between somewhere typically of about £30,000 to £50,000 over the course of 3 years. But not only that, they're getting whacked with quite high interest on these loans. Mm. And I think actually it's a little bit sneaky what's going on at the moment, in the fact that this interest is getting charged while students haven't even graduated. So they're getting interest on their, you know, loans, but they've got no means to pay it off because they haven't got employment. And I always thought that was kind of the 101 basics of how student loan finance worked. So what that means, if you are borrowing £30,000-£40,000 and you are getting whacked with interest that's RPI plus whatever percent, you might be facing interest rates of 6% on £40,000. And that's a high price to pay for your education. Now, there have been certain financial experts saying that student loans should be viewed more as a tax rather than a loan.
What's your view about that?
But the thing is, as someone that still has a student loan, bearing in mind I graduated in 2008, bearing in mind I went when tuition fees were £1,200, bearing in mind that I didn't actually even have to pay my tuition fees because of my circumstances at home, and I still rang up a pretty sizable debt that I'm still paying off today, I see it as a debt. Yeah. You know, it's something for me that it does hang around your neck a little bit. But saying that, I would never, ever want to say that to put anyone off going to university. It should be that people from all walks of life, if university fits and suits them, they should be able to go and get a university education. In my mind, that's what I think. And if you start running up this and you kind of say, well, it's not a debt, and you don't need to think of it in that way, it's very, I can't sit here and say that that's how I feel. Personally, I feel like it's a debt that has been there that I want to pay off and get rid of. The issue is that most students, I would argue now, taking out these higher loans and these higher interest rates, are probably never going to pay them off. You know, why are we doing this? It's such a strange way to be doing this. I don't get it.
Be that as it politically
may. Yeah, sorry, I'm going down a bit of a rabbit hole here. So what the reader's asking is whether they should just pay their student, pay their child's student loan off. Shouldn't just pay it off. They've got the means just to pay it off.
Or get a house.
Or put it towards a deposit. And then actually what we've looked into here is whether that is worthwhile or whether you could be thinking about doing something else, such as putting it in a stocks and shares ISA, You obviously got a £20,000 limit, so you wouldn't be able to put £40,000 in straight away. But whether that you could invest and perhaps outperform the interest that's going on your child's student loan, and then hopefully they'll get a job and start paying it off. But even then, you've got to have quite a high starting salary to start paying this off now, Georgie. It's quite difficult, I would say, to get rid of a student loan. I'd be very interested in 30 years' time to see how many student loans from 30 years ago have been paid off in full,
yeah.
You know, and how much has been left. Anyway, you can look at all these options of what to do. One of the options in here that you can do is also think about perhaps getting them a lifetime ISA to buy a property a little bit further down the line. I know in the most recent podcast, we were talking about the pressures that young people feel to get on the property ladder, and possibly where we're so obsessed with property in this country, it might not be the right fit for someone, you know, 22, 23, just graduated from university in a first job to start looking to get on the property ladder. Absolutely. It's quite, I would say, another unnecessary burden to put yourself through. You know, yes, you might need to be renting somewhere, but a mortgage is a different entity, and you don't know where your career might take you, you know.
And the good thing about the lifetime ISA, of course, is that you put in £4,000, the government tops it up by £1,000, but you can't get your hands on the money.
Yeah, unless you put it towards property or...
So property, or it can be used towards sort of a pensiony
retirement, what is this all about type thing.
But 22-year-old kids can't get their hands on it, which was the point I was
trying to make. And actually, I personally, I think after a couple of years, if you've built it up to, say, £15,000 or £20,000, with the top ups with 25% return, you're not going to get elsewhere, and you're definitely probably by that point thinking about getting a property. Perhaps that's the more sensible option. Yeah. I think the temptation is though for parents when they are fortunate enough to have such a large sum like that. I mean, one of my first thought processes was, well, couldn't they just help put you through uni? But that's a big burden for a parent to carry, to think that they'd need to pay for you to go for university. And I know we've had this chat on a podcast before some while ago, where I was talking about my own young daughter who's going to turn one next month, how I have a plan together to save her between £50,000 and £100,000 by the time she reaches 18. You can listen to that podcast, where basically we're saving £75 a month each, my wife and I, and that is the goal. Because I feel very lucky. I feel lucky just to have been born in this country and gone through the education system and all that type of thing. But then I feel very lucky to have gone through the university system as well. And I think it is just a crying shame. Again, I know I'm going off on a bit of a tangent here, that people might feel like they can't put themselves through it because of financial constraints. And I just don't want that burden.
I agree with you. No, sorry, I agree with you. I also think it would be a shame if we see situations like, you know, given a choice, are you going to, and I think we're already seeing it, are you going to pick something like history, which I did?
Mm.
Would I think, you know, now, if I was 18, that I would do history? Because the choice for me was history or science.
I know, Georgia, and I think back to being 18, I was a very, very immature person at 18. Of course I was. You know, I've just come out of sixth form. I've been wrapped up in cotton wool my whole life, really. You know, I've had a very lucky life. And then it gets 18, it's like, all right, I'm going to go to university. And then I fill out the UCAS form on the day, and I pick the universities on the day, and I pick the course subject on the day. And it's a lot of pressure. Someone that's just then sat through a load of A-levels, It's like, where's the breathing space? Yeah. Where's the kind of, these things can't be taken lightly, you know? And that's what I fear, that these big tuition fees and loans are pushing people into doing. And yeah, I just...
We'll drag it back from the politics, Simon, because I know that we've discussed this before, but I'd want to get your views on this and what you think as to whether a parent should be looking at the idea of paying off a student loan or putting it towards a deposit, or perhaps investing it for there, because you're the investing guru.
Well, in theory, no, you shouldn't pay off their student loan, because the way the system is worked out is that lots of people won't ever clear their student loan. You can look at the maths and work out roughly whether your child is going to end up or down. And there's some good figures that were done by AJ Bell that we've got in our story here. So on a starting salary of £25,000, if your earnings went up by 3% annually and you had the current student loan interest rates and repayment thresholds, then your total loan repayments made after 30 years would be £39,545, at which point, because of the interest, you would have a loan outstanding of £155,000, right? But obviously your loan would then be wiped, and your money made or lost compared to borrowing £50,000 would be, you'd be up by £10,000. But this starting salary can, even just a little bit, right, can make a big difference. And then it's whether how much your earnings go up by. Because if your earnings go up by 3% a year on average from 25 grand, just to put that into the picture, 15 years later, right, so say you started work at 25.
Yeah.
15 years later, by the time you hit 40, you'd be on £39,000, okay? So people can now picture that. They go, okay, yeah, well, I think, yeah, that might be me. Or they can work back from where they are now or whatever. But if your earnings went up just that bit more, so you were on 45 grand or 50 grand, all of a sudden things changed slightly. And even that starting salary, because if you started on 27,500, your total loan repayments over the 30 years would be £50,000. Your loan outstanding would still be £150,000. But and you'd be £249 down. But if you start on 35 grand, your total loan repayments are £82,000. Your loan outstanding at the end is £115,000. But you end up 32 grand down. And if you started on 45, so if you were big, most people don't start on something like 45, but some people do, you would make total loan repayments over 25 years, over 30 years, sorry, of £125,000. You'd have you'd still have a £30,000 loan outstanding at the end of 30 years, and you'd be 75 grand down on the whole system. So if your kid is going to be a higher earner,
yeah.
Then it is actually potentially worth paying it off, because you will save them a lot of money. If your kid's earning potential isn't going to be that great, then they're probably going to end up winning. Ironically, though, if you are a real high earner and you go into something like a city law firm or something, the places where people are starting on like £70,000, £80,000 salaries, which is completely mad, right? They'll get that loan cleared relatively quickly, and they should probably be all right. It is, as Lee said, a completely crackerjack system. And the fact is that it's so galling. And George wrote a column about this recently where he said it is so galling that because of the way that it works with this crazy high interest rate, which is, you know, RPI, discredited inflation measure, RPI, plus 3%. If you're earning above a certain amount, or if you're not earning at all while you're still a student, which is the maddest bit of a really mad system, is that's how it suddenly the debt goes up by so much. If it was just set at effectively zero real interest rates, which is what it was when I was at university, so it was just the inflation figure, although even then they used the dodgy inflation figure, not the official inflation figure. If it was that, it would be better. But people are spending years paying this money off. They do have a debt attached to their person. So it is a debt. It's not a tax. It's a debt. It's a loan. And yet they know that the whole thing is completely pointless, because what's happening is at the same time as they're making repayments, the repayments aren't actually really paying any of the debt off. The debt's continuing to rise, and eventually the government's just going to wipe it. I don't think that's the best way to teach people about their finances and to manage their finances. I'm also not entirely convinced how many 18-year-olds actually realise quite what they're signing up to. So if you are a parent, this kind of thing terrifies you. But you should actually, to act logically, not pay it off at all. But if you do decide to pay it off, then you could pay it off and then just get them to pay you back instead. And then if you want to be very generous, you could put the payments they're paying you back into some fund that actually goes to them. And then eventually they benefit from it.
I think also what it highlights is how much more there needs to be financial education in school as well, because I don't remember any kind of financial education at school whatsoever. I mean, you know, I was never explained how a student loan worked, for example. I might have been sent a pack through the post, but I would never have looked at that at age 18. Really, I don't know. Maybe things have changed, and you can let us know if things have changed. But if you're in sixth form or in college and you're 16, 17, 18, you should be sat down, even as a group, to be explained, you know, this is a typical tuition fee. This is what you might be borrowing to fund accommodation and that type of thing. But here's the interest that's going to be potentially slapped on this. I think that's what annoys me, Georgie, the most. I think that's what annoys me about this. Fair enough. Okay, tuition fees have gone up. Okay, you know, let's swallow that for a moment. It's the fact that the interest rate is set so high that it makes it almost impossible to pay off.
Yeah.
And now the student loan I'm paying off at the moment, I looked at the interest rate and it's 1.5%.
Yeah.
You know, that's way more palatable, isn't it, than 6%. And I've borrowed probably half the amount that a typical student...
Pees me off. You can get a loan for a heck of a lot cheaper than that, just going to the bank.
Well, there's a little cottage industry now popping up of student finance. George wrote about this a little while ago, but even then, you know, the rates are a little bit higher than what you would just get on a bank. And of course, as a student, it's very unlikely you're going to be able to get a bank loan through 18 years old for enough to cover you through your university education. Look, George, I could go on about this for ages, it's upsetting. I think it's upsetting. I think what I think upsets me, and I'll have the finishing point on this, is that there might be someone out there that is so talented in something, and they need to have that university education to further their talent in that. But they might be put off because they don't have the financial means. And I think that...
I'm confident that will be the case in many situations.
And
absolutely.
That's not what the education system should be. And for me, it needs to be massively overhauled.
I'm quite old school. I actually think it should be free because I think it benefits the whole of society to have an educated society. But, you know, that's quite controversial. Not everyone agrees with me, but there you go. So, in sum, the advice to... the parent was exactly what Simon had said. I mean, it all depends on your own circumstance and what you want, etc., etc. But as I mentioned a short time ago, the first thing you probably need to consider is, are you financially, I mean, this reader was, but are you financially in a secure place before you start thinking about paying off, you know, your kids' loans or buying them a house or putting down a deposit? So savers now are being sent newly revamped and shortened wake-up packs about their pensions. A bit of a slap round the face, if you will. So soon you'll know exactly how much you have in your pot and if you can spend anything now and where you can go for help should you need it. So, Simon, just tell us what is happening, whether it's a good idea.
Yes, it is a good idea. So it's short documents, few pages in length, that should tell savers the current size of their pot, indicate the income it might generate in retirement, what they're being charged, how the pension is invested, and where to turn for help. And this is going to go out to over 50s. And the idea is that this is going out to people at a point when they still have time to actually do something about this, because lots of people might open them and go, oh, I was kind of hoping I was going to have a bit more money than that. And so it gives them time to actually engage with their pension, to think about, right, can I start paying more money in? Because if you do that at 50 rather than at 60, it's going to make a very big difference. I mean, you've got 10 years of earning and 10 years of paying into it, but 10 years of investment growth and everything else. So the idea is these wake-up packs get sent out to people who've got defined contribution pensions who are investing their money for their own retirement, and they can get updated on it properly and they can actually do something to act. And if we recall the podcast that we did a couple of weeks back about how much do you need for a comfortable retirement, there was that brilliant piece of research by the Pensions and Lifetime Savings Association with the minimum, moderate and comfortable retirement. The comfortable one gets you your £8 bottle of Sauvignon Blanc. And people need to think in terms of a 10, 20, 30,000 pound a year for each of those. And you've got your state pension, which is about £8,000 a year. And then you're going to need to fund the extra money on top of that.
I'm just wondering a quick one. And the okay, say you are over 50 and you get this wake-up call and it goes, sorry, you haven't got a lot in your pot, have you? I won't literally say that, but that's maybe what you feel. What on earth can you do about it?
You could try and save some more money. I mean, that is ultimately the tough medicine kind of answer to it.
Yeah.
You need to start, you know, making some savings and saving some more money, because all the money that you can get into that pension pot, you obviously get tax relief on it. Most people will have some money matched by their employers. A lot of people will be self-employed as well, and so they need to really think about it. But you need to start getting the money in there, because then you're putting it to one side. It can be invested, it can be growing, and you might think, I can't deal with this now, but you're highly unlikely to be able to deal with it in 10 years' time.
I was going to say, it just also would highlight the importance of saving when you're much younger, as opposed to leaving it all to the last minute when you're in your 50s. Now, not saying that everyone's going to get one of these wake-up calls and it's going to have to completely overhaul their finances, but if you are someone in their 50s that gets one of these wake-up packs, realise that you need to be doing more to save for a more comfortable retirement. Again, if you have children, I would give it as a financial education lesson. There needs to be more financial education lessons in this country, Georgie, and it should start from parents and grandparents to, you know, pass down, you know, nuggets of wisdom and information and things that they wish that they'd done when they were younger, including saving harder for a pension.
All right. Well, let's hopefully finish on a slightly lighter note, because we do talk a lot about coins. I know, Lee, that you are not the coin man anymore, but you were. you were. So how about being the comic man? Because, yes, as we do love a good story about coins being worth more than their face value. But what else might be worth an unexpected pretty penny? Well, you have a latest Cash in the Attic piece. And what's been discovered is a comic book. Now, I particularly like this story because while I don't have coins, Lee, from the United States or otherwise, listen back to a previous podcast, I do have some cool X-Men and Star Wars comics from the 80s. Am I rich?
First of all, can I just say, no, you are not cool. sorry, Georgie.
I am totally cool.
No, you are not cool. That does not make you cool that in my book. Cool. I'm sorry. Yes, we've got a Cash in the Attic here about a Judge Dredd comic. Is my Judge Dredd worth some bread? Mm. Well, actually, it seems that in some circumstances it can be, as can a lot of comic books. But the key with a lot of this, especially things like comics and toys, is original packaging. It's having everything that's with it, that came with it, and it not being messed up by little sticky kid fingers, which is basically what happens with 99.9% of comic books and toys, hence which makes them more expensive as time goes on, because to find those kind of prime examples can be quite difficult because they've been read or they've been ripped, yeah, or they've been destroyed or sunlight's got to them and made them fade and all of that kind of thing. You have to be a certain kind of child, I would imagine, to get your hands on a Judge Dredd comic and probably never look inside it and keep it in its plastic packaging to then reap the rewards 30 years later and sell it at an auction for £10,000. But that's what we've got here. So recently there was a cover of Judge Dredd, King of the Streets. It went for almost £10,000. It was drawn in 1981. It wasn't actually a comic. It was just a front cover of the comic. So hence why they looked into this. And there's some common examples, actually. There's one pictured in a story. Obviously, it's got half me to describe what's going on over the radio, on the podcast, over, you know, Judge Dredd. I'm no expert on comic books or Judge Dredd.
Yeah.
But there's this one from March 1977. It sounds like it's pretty relatively common. It cost 8 Earth pence. And it can sell for £500. And what I would say is, if you have a stack of comic books and you don't know if they're worth anything, I would start with the presumption that they're not worth anything and then work your way up. If you've got someone, so in your X-Men comic books, Georgie, or one of those, you know, if you had like something that's perhaps like the first volume of a certain series or that type of thing, the internet's your friend.
It's French.
You know,
I don't know why it's in French.
It's French.
But it's in French. I'm taking a look online.
You said
a dollar, that, I think you can get it for.
That's made you even less cool.
But the
internet is your friend in this type of thing. You know, there are lots of people, I was going to say nerds, but that's not the right term. There's a lot of
cool people,
enthusiasts, that can guide you as to whether or not a certain comic book is worth money. But, you know, it's probably very, very,
even
very
this, look
unlikely.
At this, Marvel Comics, X-Men, first issue, A Legend Reborn.
First issue, though,
Georgie. 1991, mint condition. How much do you reckon?
4 Bitcoin.
Which, depending on when this podcast goes out,
anything. That's either $32,000 or $42,000, depending on what minute you listen to this.
Yeah, 12 pence. It's 75 quid. So I'm not rich because mine's certainly not in mint condition. I don't know what they're worth in France either. Simon?
Is it rare? That's the first question.
Yeah.
Is it in good condition? That's the second question. Doesn't mean it's not worth anything. It'd probably be worth more than the cover price, because if people are after old comics for their collection, but you won't be retiring on it.
It's what it means to you. Cool people out there who also... Shut up, Lee. Right, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or any cool comics, do let us know.
Email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, tweet us @thisismoney, or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all of the articles and explain to Georgie what her French Judge Dredd comic is about.
It's not Judge Dredd, it's X-Men.
Please don't.
Oh.
It's not Judge Dredd.
And please don't send pictures of your comics.
X-Om.
En français.
I don't want pictures of your comic books coming through my inbox, thank you.
All right, some people might. Some people like that, Lee. So, anyway, if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? Helps people find us.